Senate Select Committee on Prison Safety, April 29, 2019, room 643, LOB, 3 p.m. Bam.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, committee members. Nice to have you all here. We are going to have a presentation this afternoon on the, as we continue our meetings here as the Senate Select Committee on Prison Safety. First of all, I'd like to, if I may, introduce the Senate Sergeant at Arms who are assisting us today. We've got Terry Edmondson. Terry, Archie Smith is also with us today. Hey, Archie. And Frank Urban is here as well. I know he's right behind me. Hello, Frank. Good to see you. First order of business, you all should have or have received your minutes from the last meeting we had. And if so, a motion to accept those minutes as presented would be appropriate at this time, or if you have some changes you'd like to see made that you think are inaccurate, it's time to do that. Let's do that as well. So we have a motion to so move. Okay. Senator Sanderson moves to accept the minutes from the last meeting. Do we have a second? Thank you, Senator Bergen. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes accepted. Okay, our presentation this morning, this afternoon rather, excuse me, is the from the FMRT group, psychological and medical support for safety-sensitive employers, and that is, this is the committee on safety reforms for our prisons, so this should be fascinating, and certainly we're delighted to have you here and to make the presentation. This is Elizabeth Morris. So, Elizabeth, the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Morris. I am the CEO and managing team member for the FMRT group. We specialize in psychological and medical support for safety-sensitive employers. We've been in business now for 14 years. We are an outgrowth of Dr. John Warren's forensic psychology practice, which has been around for 38 years. He is board certified in both police and public safety psychology, as well as board certified in forensic psychology. He's one of only 66 in the nation and one of three in North Carolina. Why am I here? I'm here to discuss how the FMRT group has proudly supported adult corrections, prisons, for the past 4 years. I am here to inform you of the comprehensive medical and psychological screening processes of correctional officer applicants that will now be stopped. Due to the decision of prisons that has made to implement a back-to-basics negligent hiring practice, which will no doubtably lead to bad outcomes for our correction officers, for our inmates, and this state. Let's begin with why we are the experts. We've performed more than 47,000 pre- and post-hire psychological evaluations and medical evaluations in the last 14 years. We only support safety-sensitive professionals, which include 450 police, sheriffs, prisons, EMS, fire, probation and parole, private security, and federal departments in North Carolina and beyond. We have intimate knowledge about both statewide issues, national trends, and best practices for psychology and medicine in these industries. We remain the thought leaders in the industry of public safety psychology and medicine by attending local, state, and national conferences, trainings, and meetings. We have firsthand knowledge of what's going on outside and inside our departments, including prisons, which includes our clinical staff interactions with correctional officers, supervisors, and inmates. Dr. Warren alone visits our North Carolina prisons at least 20 times a year. As the expert, he ensures that our culturally aware clinical psychologists of 18 take part in biannual trainings with him, in addition to trainings from Psychological Services Chapter of International Association of Chiefs of Police. To give you some history, we started a pilot program with prisons in late 2014. And in 2015, we had the opportunity to provide them with a robust hiring process consisting of best practices for screening correctional officers, medical and psychological suitability, as what we call a one-stop shop. Correctional officers candidates had 7 office locations in North Carolina to choose from to have everything completed in one day. The process was initiated at the time due to recognition from knowledgeable state leaders in and outside of the prisons, including former Commissioner Geis, that psychological and medical hiring practices were not compliant with criminal justice education, training and standards, or professional standards. He felt compelled to make the necessary changes to their medical and psychological screening procedures in order to minimize litigation risk and ethical manner by unbiased party. At the time, administrators who were testing applicants couldn't keep up, and neither could the sole source provider. We embarked in a 4-year partnership where we've evaluated more than 18,000 correctional officer candidates, provided them with, in their own words, better quality applicants, and ultimately allowed us to support prisons with a one-day hiring process that started in June. It is because of our 14 years working with public safety and this close partnership that we were able to meet the unique demands of the 55 prison facilities. What are the physical and mental standards of criminal justice education, training, and standards? That every person have a psychological screening examination by a clinical psychologist. How do experts in the field of psychology and medicine define an examination? Since 1981, and based on case law from McLean versus Sale, it has been determined that the word examination for medical psychological purposes requires the physical presence of the examiner. In recent years, it has expanded to one-on-one telemedicine, telepsychology examinations. Under national guidelines for psychological and medical evaluations of public safety professionals based on International Association of Chiefs of Police, it states, the suitability and medical evaluations of public safety for safety-sensitive positions should be examined in the context of the essential job functions using interview, cognitive assessment, inquiry into relevant history, testing for both normal and abnormal personality traits, and other factors including conscientiousness, demeanor, spoken and written language skills. Our public safety psychologists, all doctoral level, know the essential job functions of correctional officers after seeing thousands of applicants. Our lead psychologist alone, who's here today, Dr. Peter Scholes, has seen more than 5,000 candidates. Our clinical staff also meets the IACP, again, International Association of Chiefs of Police Psych Services Section, examiner qualifications, which state, they must provide assessment services that are within their boundaries and competence. They must be trained and experienced specifically in the provision of pre-employment psychological evaluations for public safety positions. They must participate in regular, ongoing, continuing education and training that is specific to pre-employment screenings, in addition to that of more general public safety psychology nature. They must base their work on established scientific and professional knowledge of the discipline. They must be familiar with employment law impacting the conduct of pre-employment psychological evaluations, including but not limited to ADA, ADAAA, GINA, and other federal and state laws. They must adhere to the ethical principles and standards for practice in their profession. They must decline to accept a pre-employment psychological evaluation referral when personal, professional, legal, financial, or other competing interests could reasonably be expected to impair their objectivity, competence, or effectiveness in performing these functions, which is why prison psychologists should not assess psychological suitability or take part in the determination of psych or medical suitability of candidates for correctional officer positions due to their competing interests, in order to avoid role confusion, loose standards, bending of the rules, susceptibility to bribes and undue influence, or other bad acts that ultimately expose the organization to increased risks, including criminal behaviors and civil complaints of negligent hiring. I will now go over the previous comprehensive evaluation process that prisons has been doing and is choosing to stop. These processes are best practices, rigorously tested over the years, are defensible, and are designed by a board-certified police and public safety psychologist in both forensics and police psychology in order to prevent bad outcomes. And it only takes 5 to 7 business days for prison's decision makers to receive the report. This process includes the BRAINS assessment. This is our online biographical instrument. Then there's also the California Personality Inventory, which assesses normal personality and has a police and public safety services report. The Personality Assessment Inventory, the PAI, looks at abnormal personality. We also assess IQ by using the Shipley. We also give a writing skills assessment. And the clinical interview, which is done after the psychologist has looked at all of the assessment data, which is very important to have the testing done before and examined by the psychologist prior to the clinical interview. Otherwise, the psychologist is going into a blind interview. In the structured interview, the examiner assesses behaviors, attitudes, inquiry into their medical, psychological, and related history, education, both vocational, military, and other historical data points. The psychologist also has a structured assessment of memory, problem solving, abstracting ability, and drills down on issues uncovered in totality of other factors. A contemporary national study by Dr. David Corey determined that the majority of public safety psychologists follow this standard of practice with regard to administering both a test of normal and abnormal personality functioning, conducting a clinical interview no less than 30 minutes after they review the testing data. And they do not disqualify candidates on the basis of a single test score. Our public safety psychologists go above and beyond to address real-life scenarios of correctional officers during the clinical interview process. A few include command presence, how a correctional officer would handle. It's a two-point game. It's chow time, and you're solely responsible for getting inmates to the lunchroom. A minor situation, but tell me how you'd resolve quickly. How would you set a precedent so they know what they can and cannot get away with? Our psychologists have been taught to even recognize gang tattoos. Since over the past 4 years, this can be missed in prison's pre-screening process, along with immediate family members being in the prison facilities. Suicide awareness. Our psychologists talk to the applicants about signs to recognize if someone may be in danger, do harm to themselves or others. They ask how they'd handle themselves, or how do they feel about mental health themselves, and how do they feel about going to someone in the facility to ask for help. They are asked how they handle learning of a colleague that is bringing in contraband to the facility. Both the psychological and medical examiners discuss their medication and get the records from their primary care physicians to ensure right dosages. Important things to know and have documented if someone were taking a sedative and they work third shift, or are bipolar and need to ensure that they are taking the right dosages and the last time that they've seen their psychiatrist or family doctor. They ask how they handle stress and what resources they, if they felt depressed, anxious, or having suicidal thoughts. Since the research shows that correctional officers are 2 times more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder than a military veteran, and 2 times more likely to commit suicide than a police officer, they are 39% higher risk than all other professionals. Our psychologists are proactive and do their due diligence before we put them in this environment. In June, we began a one-day hiring model of a few prisons facilities, and in November 2018, we were up to 24. However, the statement we've heard from prisons leadership is that there's a one-day hiring process in all 55 facilities, which is not currently the case based on the 2 processes we've been running. This one-day process shows that after an applicant goes through processing with their regional employment officer, which is number 5, the applicant is seen the same day by FMRT psychologists, medical professionals, as well as their drug screening, which you see in number 6, which are all located in the same area as the REO's office or within reasonable miles from the facility. Again, the reports and standard forms required by criminal justice, education, training, and standards are sent back to the prison's administrators within 5 to 7 business days. This next slide is the hiring process we started in 2015 and have continued with the remaining 31 facilities that are not part of the one-day hiring model. If you can imagine, running 2 processes can be confusing and impactful on timing and efficiency for prison's regional employment officers and has been for our staff. However, we've done this successfully and have tracking to show. Even with running 2 processes, we are able to show that the time getting the applicant in to turnaround of the report is 15 to 20 days total. To schedule, be seen for their psychological, their physical, and their drug screening, gathering records from the VA or their primary care physician, to detailed narrative reports, delivery day. If the one-day model would have been implemented across the state, these numbers would change dramatically. FMRT has 7 offices where we've seen, on average, 250 applicants a month for psychological and medical evaluations, drug screenings, TB. I'm proud to say that our team has also worked collaboratively with the regional employment officers to develop solutions that remove steps and workload from them and were taken on by FMRT staff. We have seen a difference in the short time this was implemented prior to prison's decision. In 4 years, we have executed more than 18,000 psychological and medical evaluations, and between 11 to 17% have been found to be psychologically weak or not suitable. We recognize the baseline is needing people, in fact, from inside, stating they just need bodies on post. However, the 11 to 17% of those have gleaming malignant traits, behaviors, their own mental health concerns that would be detrimental, and even learning of immediate family members in prison, which would put current correctional officers and inmates at risk. The next pie chart shows that over the past 4 years, there have been 7% of applicants to be found not medically suitable due to morbid obesity, sugar in their urine due to untreatable diabetes, which exposes them to catastrophic events. High blood pressure, which if gone untreated, can lead to life-threatening events. Substance in their urine, drug screening that's not been disclosed, such as opioids, and not being able to meet the essential job function requirements. Our medical professionals know essential job functions and follow criminal justice training and standard medical guidelines to help determine medical suitability of these correction officers. We currently have a robust physical and psychological screening process that informs both the psychologist and medical professional that ensure collaboration, checks and balances, and conversation with one another. What you will see in just a few minutes will show that prisons has decided to uncouple these 2 best practices. Certainly, it will not reduce the time in the hiring process, but more importantly, it increases holes in the overlap of these professions. We don't know whether prisons will maintain criminal justice, education, training, and standard requirements for medical evaluations, and encourage you to ask about this and the physical agility processes that have been suspended. We are only speculating that prisons will either have physicals done internally or through independent urgent care facilities, which will cause issues. One being that the medical personnel within the facilities are quite busy with their own inmate health initiatives and lack of staff. Based on what Dr. Junker presented, the clinical department has 33 vacancies, yet we're talking about adding, at minimum, 3,000 hours of work to staff. This is based on historical data. And urgent cares will not have the time or take the time to learn essential job functions and the many intricacies of a correctional officer's job. Our professionals know they are working 12 or more hours a day, they need to be agile, that they are working in prisons without air conditioning, that they need to be able to respond to critical incidents, which is why providers that don't know this field do not need to be assessing medical suitability, and we do not need to put more on the internal staff that has the obligations of inmate health. This information alone should cause you as the committee to pause and ask, back to basics, is that the right mindset when we no longer live in a basic world? What you'll see here is this is part of a tracking report. We have provided prisons every month. The detailed tracking document provides them with every applicant that is seen for a psychological, medical, and drug screening, when they're scheduled, how long it took to be scheduled, when the reports are completed and sent, along with records requests. We have provided you with 3 months of tracking in your packet, along with Criminal Justice Education Training and Standard Guidelines and International Association of Chiefs of Police Guidelines. We are not the rate-limiting step. Based on internal surveys gathered over the past years, we understand that 73% of applicants stated it took 2 to 3 months from the time they submitted their application to the time they were asked to do their psychological and medical evaluation. We learned from Mr. Gary Moore in a previous presentation that their current process takes 120 days. Our tracking and surveys show that the rate limiting steps are due to internal processes and not the time it takes for a comprehensive and legally defensible medical and psychological procedures. The solution is not to drastically minimize mental and physical suitability standards because prisons incorrectly believes or needs an excuse for the process taking too long. We base our information on knowledge and data, and we're happy to share more. Here is prison's new process. On April 12th, prisons awarded a process based on their request for proposal that is in direct violation of the state's criminal justice, education, training, and standards. It is not legally defensible, and it is not supported by state and national legal, psychological, and medical experts. Prisons will only send 250 applicants to the psychologist each year. However, based on 4 years of data, more than 250 will be hired. Again, on average, we've seen 250 correctional officer candidates a month for their psychological evaluation, physical, and drug screening. An applicant that only takes the MMPI 2RF and does not see a psychologist violates EEOC regulations and American psychological and ethical standards, leaving the department open to litigation and bad outcomes. This process will lead to injuries and harm to both correctional officers and inmates. A failure to evaluate job applicants for historical and psychological and negative psychological characteristics of essential job functions will allow persons without the ability and or with negative tendencies to be placed in a position of power, authority, and control over others. The most recent test developer of the MMPI 2RF, Dr. Yosef Ben Parath, states that the assessment should not be used as a complete and independent psychological report of an individual. It's a combination of background, use of other assessments, and clinical observations to best assess suitability. When asked specifically about North Carolina prison's plan, he stated, "This is not a procedure I would personally recommend." Here are some of the new process pitfalls. Fact, the MNPI does not assess psychological suitability as required by criminal justice training and standards. The MNPI does not have a cutoff score. The test is not a pass-fail. Suitability is only assessed with a battery of testing. Fact, according to international guidelines and standards, it is highly unethical and not legally defensible for a psychologist to determine suitability with only one test. Fact, the new process does not meet criminal justice education training and standards, EEOC or ADA violations. Fact, unethical for anyone on staff to assess applicants. It is fact that there will be no liability sharing. Fact, that this will be a risk to officers and inmate safety. And fact, everyone will not be seen by a psychologist. The misleading data that's been shared that insinuates that this new process brings North Carolina closer in line with hiring practices in other state correctional systems is clearly not correct, at least for most populous states. For example, major corrections departments in the country use a model that's legally mandated in California that requires an in-person or telepsych clinical interview, at least two assessments, and a detailed narrative report determining psychological suitability. A few, New York State Department of Corrections, Washington State Department of Corrections, Alaska, New York City, and all counties in California, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and Nevada. The list is much longer if you were to do more research. Issues that will not be detected in prison's back-to-basics approach. Issues are culturally aware psychologists and medical professionals have encountered that will not be adequately detected include criminal behaviors that go undetected because the applicant never got caught, dating or living with convicted felons and or habitual drug users, parents who have been investigated by Child Protective Services for abuse or neglect, victims of physical or sexual abuse, making them prone to want to seek retaliation against inmates or be fearful of inmates. Applicants with timid demeanors who lack a command presence, are soft-spoken, or afraid to be in front of a crowd. Applicants with aggressive demeanors who look forward to, in quotes, pepper-spraying inmates. Veterans with 70% to 100% disability ratings for traumatic brain injury or mental health problems. Many of them cannot tolerate loud noises, confined spaces, sudden movements, or being around people who look dangerous. Applicants with racial, religious, or sexual orientation bias. Numerous applicants who indicate having been laid off on their applications, however, upon further inquiry in the clinical interview, they were terminated for physical fights with coworkers and customers, consuming alcohol at work, using cell phone at work, excessive tardiness, sexual harassment, stalking behaviors, stealing, laziness, and sleeping on the job. Applicants with severe sleep problems who not be able to tolerate working 12-hour shifts, rotating shifts, or being mandated to work overtime. Extremely outspoken applicants with no personal boundaries who have been disciplined at work for using offensive language or expressing their political views in a demonstrative manner. Applicants with histories of sexual deviance or who dress seductively for the interview, act flirtatious, and are at a high risk for sexual misconduct with inmates. Applicants with extremely poor integrity who blatantly lie on their application materials. Applicants with active disability or workers' compensation claim who openly admit that they only want the job so they can get health insurance in order to have major surgeries. Financial irresponsibility, vehicle recently repossessed, recent evictions from residents. Y'all get the point. Why correctional officers didn't accept the position. Few quotes from them. From my interview and acceptance, it was going to be 6 months before I started the job. Inadequate pay, expensive health insurance plan was so bad that I wouldn't be able to support and take care of myself and my family. No way I could afford to live in Wilmington and afford to work for one of the lowest paid state corrections in the country. I felt that I wasn't offered enough money for the 10 years of experience that I would bring required, and also long time travel. I was offered less money in North Carolina than staying with Virginia Department of Corrections, and I would have lost $13,000 in salary because I haven't worked in this state before. We firmly understand that in North Carolina and throughout the nation, prisons are facing shortages of correctional officers, supervisors, support staff, including medical and psychological providers for inmates in the prisons. I know this causes tremendous pressure on leadership of prisons and the entire organization. I am certain that finding a solution to this problem has got to be one of their primary objectives. However, lowering standards and cutting out a strenuous vetting process to ensure quality applicants is unacceptable and should not even be an option. Their own data shows that they don't have enough clinicians for inmate health, so why would they put more work on the staff and think that it would be faster? That is why outside, unbiased professionals in this industry should support them in finding psychological and medically suitable candidates, and prisons should look inward to focus on the real problems, which are retention due to insufficient pay, supervisors that should not be overseeing staff, and the environment as a whole. As the slide above, this shows a number of reasons why people don't take the job once a conditional offer is given. Don't be mistaken by the idea of incorporating a diminished hiring process simply because it saves time. That is a blatant lie, and as you've seen, we have the data above and surveys and knowledge to prove it. Here is a comparison of the previous prison's comprehensive process on the left and the new process that will be implemented May 1st on the right. As a last reminder, the suitability of applicants for safety-sensitive positions should be examined in context of the essential job functions using interview, cognitive assessment, inquiry into relevant history, testing for both normal and abnormal personality traits, and other factors, including conscientiousness, demeanor, both spoken and written language. Not one test with or without a clinical interview. In summary, over the past 4 years, every correctional officer applicant has gone through a robust medical and psychological process. Effective immediately, only 1/12 of candidates that score outside some predetermined range will be seen by a psychologist. I cannot imagine having to sit across from a grieving family, a litigator, or a reporter and explain away bad outcomes due to the fact we either put someone in an environment that should have never been, explain why we spend $35 million on inmate mental health but stopped caring about assessing the mental health of our correctional officers, or explain away incidents inside of prisons caused by employing unfit employees. The diminished process that takes effect May 1st is decades old. It will be in direct violation of the state's criminal justice standards, and again, it is not legally defensible or supported by national experts. We cannot stand by idly as prisons puts inmates and correctional officer lives at risk. Thank you.
Ms. Morris, thank you very much for your presentation. We'll open the floor up for questions among the committee members. If there are any questions, yes, Senator Waddell.
Thank you for this report. It seems to be very thorough and very extensive. And I was wondering, as you spoke about and gave us information on the number of correction officers that took the test and the number that actually accepted the job, it seems to be like a lot of testing. That's a lot for one day. So is there any way through observations that you can eliminate some things that you see before taking anybody through all of this test?
Morris?
Yes, I mean, there are a number of components in prison's hiring practice that they look at some of the pre-screening prior to. Once they're seen by the psychologist, though, it only takes 5 to 7 business days for a psychological report to be given. And like I said, it's based on national standards, both for, psychologists and medical professionals, that they perform and complete the test of abnormal psychology or abnormal personality, normal personality. So the time it takes, again, to get them in and to get the report back is maximum 20 days. So we are not the rate limiting step in that 120-day process. But we're constantly looking out for other assessments that take less time. But 18,000 have completed all of these assessments.
Follow-up, Senator Waddell.
Yes, the next question. You talk about legal implications that moving forward, if this process was would be changed, there would be some legal avenues that we would have to travel. As you think about that, as you discuss it, has it happened yet in any other way as related to testing?
Ms. Morris?
Yes, it happened 5 years ago, which is why we were brought in. Because they were facing legal issues and bad behaviors in the prisons. And Commissioner Geis at the time realized that they were not following a robust process to assess the psychological suitability of the correctional officers.
Follow up.
I won't get into the legal any further into that, but I also wanted to know, and I guess you have this somewhere, the cost of testing of each of individuals before they get on the job. How expensive is that, and is it really worth it when it comes down to the length of time that they will stay on the job? Because I think you're saying they stay only 2 years average.
Go ahead.
Ms. Morris?
That doesn't mean that you diminish hiring practices. A retention issue is an issue within the prison system. So the price is very minimal. In other states, it's about $1,000 for pre-employment psychological assessments and evaluations. For us, it's $395.
Follow up to Senator Waddell.
Okay. After you do your initial testing and the applicant is on the job for a length of time, is there any time that you do further up testing or any time that you do additional psychological testing?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Morris.
Yes, we would like to have the opportunity to do that with previous leadership. We were heading in that direction to support the correctional officers throughout their career and check in and see how they're doing, particularly after critical incidents. But at this time, no, ma'am, we do not have any further evaluating of the correctional officers once they are hired.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Waddell. We'll now move to Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Thank you for being here. So I had asked, after you and I had met in my office, I had asked the folks from prisons, and I thought that the cost was $645 a person. Is it three?
Ms. Morris?
She was asking me about the psychological evaluations, but that is the combination with the psych physical and drug screening. In 1 year, it was $1.5 million. They have a $2.3 billion budget.
Senator Bergen, follow up.
So you all been doing it since 2014, I remember, mm-hmm. from us talking. Can talk to me about the last year, about how many were done. I know when I look at the number of people that were hired, the number of people that left, it seems like those are about an even number. So help me understand why we're not retaining, if we're spending all this money to pick the right people, it seems like we're just churning people, and I feel like if we spent $1.1 or $1.2 million last year to do all of this, it's almost a revolving door. So mm-hmm. What am I missing?
Our job is to assess the psychological and medical suitability of the individual to ensure that they don't have pathologies, that they are meeting the essential job functions, both psychologically and medically, to do the job. It is not our job to take care of them within the facility at this time. It would be prisons' retention issues, and as we've seen over the years and as we hear from supervisors, that should not be in a position of authority. As we talk about and as you hear on a daily basis, the pay, the environment, you know, we are ensuring that they are healthy enough to do the job. Once they are in there, it is the job of prisons to retain them.
Follow up. Senator Bergen, follow up.
Is there some way that there could be like a, I hate to say this, but a quick test? Because looking over these numbers, it seems like we ought to be able to get some data on folks and make a preliminary decision before we go through spending $645 on somebody and all the time and the delay, because it's taken us 120 days. I went back to some of our companies and asked how long it takes. It takes us anywhere from a day to 2 weeks to hire somebody.
Right.
And we do background check, and we do pre-employment physicals, and we do drug testing, and we do all of that. So for these jobs, these people can't afford to wait 120 days. So
you're absolutely right. Why would it take 2 to 3 months to hear back after turning in your application? You know, we are not the rate limiting step, and we give, you know, as I stated, between 15 to 20 days total. And that includes the variables of getting the person on the phone. They've got to coordinate with their current job. You know, there are uncontrolled variables to get them in. But once they're in and seen by a psychologist, it takes 5 business days. Out of 120. So again, we're not the rate limiting step, and I agree that there are uncontrolled variables that we cannot, you know, minimize. But also, I would say to you that Wake County Sheriff's Office alone, it takes 6 months for them to hire a sworn individual because they have, you know, 28 weeks of BLET. It varies. Prisons is our largest organization, but I agree that there are certain processes in place internally that is slowing them down.
Follow up. Yes, Senator Bergen, follow up.
All right. Prior to 2014, what did we do?
The diminished, unethical, or legally defensible process of a one-test model, and you go to see the psychologist. You don't have to go see the psychologist. You do. You don't. That's what we were following.
Follow up.
Follow up, Senator
Bergen. What you're saying is now that's what we're looking at going back to.
Going backwards.
Follow up.
Follow up, Senator Bergen.
You mentioned legal, and I'm understand. And since you all have been doing it since 2014, have there been any legal challenges?
No.
Or have you all had any legal issues, or have you been involved in a lawsuit because of anything that has been involved?
No, sir, not with prisons, no.
Follow up, Senator Bergen. Thank you very much for your questions. And we have now Senator McKissick.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate your presentation today. I gather from looking at this report, and you identify how many were not found to be suitable and how many were weak in terms of suitability. In terms of actual headcount, I mean, how many people are we talking about during this period?
I didn't do my math beforehand. Well, we've seen 18,000 for psychological, physical, and drug screening. And out of that, I think referring to the, we're talking about 11%, I believe, that were found to be
not
psychologically suitable.
And the other 6% were weak, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's difficult to speculate, but I take it these would have been persons who would have really not perform well or optimally for the positions they were hired in. Is that the bottom line?
Yes, sir. These are, you know, ones with malignant traits that would definitely cause concern coming into the correctional facilities. If you would like, I can address some of our clinical staff that's in the audience if you would like.
That would be appreciated if they're here.
Yes, is there someone that you would like to recognize?
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Scholes. He's our lead psychologist.
Dr. Scholes, if you'll please step to the mic, which you are doing. Make sure the mic is on. You'll have to press the button and then tell us who you are. Identify yourself, please.
Yes, my name is Peter Scholes. I'm a forensic psychologist, and I work with the FMRT group. In response to your question, sir, the kind of things that we are seeing, I think as was kind of highlighted towards the end of the presentation there, why folks are found not suitable, goes way beyond just psychopathology. The test itself can reveal a lot of that. We're looking much more in depth at a lot of anger issues, folks who have recent gang affiliations, folks who have been fired from jobs are actually getting into fight on the job, folks who are currently going through active bankruptcy, so they are very susceptible to financial bribes. The list can go on and on and on. But we're looking for folks who, if you put them in the position of a prison guard, a correction officer, they're not going to be able to rely upon to make sound decisions under pressure situations. Folks that you can rely upon in an emergency situation to stand up and make, to come to your safety.
Follow-up, Mr. Kier.
Follow-up, Senator McKissick.
And I don't know if this is a question to raise with Ms. Montgomery or whether it's best to raise it with the Department of Public Safety, but I know Commissioner Geis is somebody who I have the highest regards and respect for. And if he launched this program and this initiative, that gives me a great deal of confidence that he thought it was going to be effective in having to screen out employees that would be potentially problematic. So I guess the thing I'm trying to understand, and Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is a question to go to Ms. Montgomery or to the department, is why we are deviating from a process that appears to have been quite effective in identifying unsuitable people to be hired in our Department of Public Safety or Department of Corrections.
Senator McKissick, thank you. Is there someone from the department, Ms. Little, would you like to step up to the mic, identify yourself, please, and try to address that question the best you can? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tracy Little, Deputy Secretary for Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice in the Department of Public Safety. Senator McKissick, thank you for your question. And there are a couple of points that I would like to make with the chair's indulgence, if I might.
Certainly, go ahead.
Thank you. In reference to your immediate question, Senator McKissick, the department was deliberative in assessing where we were in our hiring process and making a determination in moving forward. We had a contractual arrangement with FMRT. We complied with all the terms and conditions of that contract, and that contract is coming to a natural end. I think all of us would agree, whether you're in business or whether you're in the public sector, that because a contract is awarded once doesn't mean that a contract is awarded forever. So in assessing where we are in our hiring process and our desire to move to a different or return to a previous business model, we assessed multiple things. And we decided that looking at the information that we had available to us, first, there is no qualitative or quantitative data that the applicants that we have been hiring since we began this business relationship with the current vendor are any that we are recruiting or hiring any better applicants. We looked at different kinds of data, and there's no data to support that. We are returning to a process that we previously used for 18 years. We never, as to the best of my knowledge, had a challenge that process was not in compliance with all state and federal laws, as well as the requirements of the Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission. That is the process that we used for that period of time. The process that we are returning to that we previously used is consistent with the process that we currently use today to hire certified staff for our for juvenile justice. This process that we are returning to does bring us back closer in line with our counterparts in state correctional systems across the country. And we do have a survey from 2017, so it is not particularly dated. But of that survey, 34 states responded and 30 states responded to whether they use some type of psychological interview for correctional officer candidates. 12 of those states indicated that they did, and 18 said they did not. I also would like to note that the Federal Bureau of Prisons does not use a face-to-face psychological interview for their candidates. So, you can always look at different states. We always like to look at our states that are around us And as an example, South Carolina, Florida, Virginia, Kentucky do not, for that survey in 2017, indicated they did not use a face-to-face interview. The state of Tennessee did. I would also like to point out a couple of inaccuracies in the presentation that you've heard today. First of all, the department has no plans to use internal clinical professionals who are hired to work with offenders for this process, either on the medical side or for the applicants who will be seeing a psychologist if they are referred for that process. So we are not planning to use internal staff for that purpose. Also, I think that there was a reference in terms of that we are calling this back to basics. That is not what we are calling this. Back to basics is a separate training model that Gary Moore, who this committee has heard from, it's a separate training model and program that he utilizes. Also, I would like to point out that the vendor has filed a formal protest as it relates to our recent procurement that we recently completed. And as a result of that formal protest being active at this time, I have been advised by legal counsel that I cannot speak directly to any of the direct allegations being made regarding to the process and the business decision that the agency has made moving forward. I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Yes, Senator McKissick.
Sure, and I guess the follow-up would be, and I don't know the extent to which you have comparative data going back beyond the time this program was implemented, but do you have anything that would support the contention that the system that we're returning to is just as effective as this one is? I mean, they were able to identify, I guess, a total of about 17% of people that were either not suitable or were weak in terms of suitability. In the past, when the department was using its own process and procedures, what percentage of those that applied for jobs were determined to be unsuitable or weak or falling into a questionable category where they were not hired due to problems that emerge, such as the ones that have been identified in this type of psychological assessment during the evaluation process?
Senator, is that question directed to Ms. Little?
Yes. I'm sensing as to what they were doing before, or if it's equally... I mean, I'm understanding that the quality of candidates is supposed to be the same, but I'm trying to see if there was a rejection rate that was roughly comparable based upon the evaluative tools that they were utilizing.
Ms. Little, I don't know if you can, in your particular position, with all of the legal nuances going on, whether you can jump in and try to answer that. But if you'd like to give it a shot, the chair will certainly allow that.
Thank you, Tracy Little, Adult Correction, Juvenile Justice. Senator McKissick, I'm not sure that I have that specific data that you have requested. We do know that we are anticipating that between 10 and 15% of the applicants who take the initial psychological screening assessment, we anticipate that they will be referred to be seen with a psychologist.
Another follow-up, if I could.
Senator McKissick with another follow-up.
I mean, going back to this process that I guess we previously utilized, I mean, are we doing it because we think we will get a better applicant pool? Are we primarily doing it to save money, to reduce time? Or what's the true goal of going back to a process that perhaps is not as deliberative? I mean, it sounds like it just won't be the same level of evaluation. So I'm trying to understand, are we trying to save money? Are we trying to save time? What are we trying to really accomplish by going back to that system?
Ms. Little.
Thank you, Senator McKissick, for that question. Tracy Little, Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice. First, let me say that the department's primary objective is to operate safe and secure facilities, and that we would never make a decision that would jeopardize our staff. And I want to make sure that the committee hears that loud and clear. This decision that we have made, it's being made on several factors, quite honestly. One is that we don't have any qualitative or quantitative data that is indicating that the people that we are hiring today, by several different measures, whether it be performance or separations or whatever the case may be, that they're a better applicant than normalizing for the group of people we hired under the prior process. So that's one thing that we're looking at. Number two, we do believe that the model that we are implementing will save time. You have heard us speak before this committee about returning, interviewing, and hiring back to local wardens in the communities that you serve and where you live. Part of this process will return that medical evaluation back to local providers. And so our applicants, we are trying to make it easier for applicants to get through the hiring process. And so one of the things that this new process will do will allow them to go to a contracted medical provider. And we now have providers in 42 counties. We have 55 facilities, so we're not exactly in every county where there is a facility. But that will make it more convenient for the applicants to go ahead and get that physical taken care of. And then they will only need to come to our regional employment office for one appointment to make sure that they are able to complete the rest of their process. So we do think that it is going to make the process quicker without sacrificing quality. It returns us to a process that we previously used, and it worked for us. I mean, we were willing to look at doing something different, and we did something different for 3 years, but we have no quantifiable evidence that we're getting a better applicant. So we're returning to something that worked for us for many years. Again, state correctional systems across the country, while some use a face-to-face psychological interview, not all of them do. And this new process will save money, nearly $1 million a year. But let me be clear, that is not the driving factor of this decision. It is a byproduct of this decision. It is not the driving factor.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And I guess a question for Ms. Little is simply this. There were Ms. Montgomery raised concerns about whether returning to this prior process and procedure was compliant with laws, rules, and regulations. So I'm trying to determine to the extent to which they can express an opinion upon whether returning to the prior procedure will be compliant with all laws, rules, regulations, or certification standards which are in place and applied to our Department of Corrections or Department of Public Safety today.
Ms. Little, would you like to
yes, sir.
Address
Thank you,
that?
Mr. Chairman. Tracy Little, Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice. Our team that looked at evaluating the process and determining what business model that we were going to move forward with was comprised of staff from human resources, so they are certainly very knowledgeable of all human resources, EEOC, ADA policies. It also was comprised of a member of our general counsel's office, who also very knowledgeable of human resources law. We had folks from the operations side of prisons. I was a member of that group. So we feel very confident that what we are putting in place is compliant with all of the requirements. And as I said, it's a process that we used for more than 15 years, and it is the process that we currently use for juvenile justice staff today.
Yeah, I would like to just make a comment if I can. Obviously, we don't want to get involved in a contractual going back and forth between the vendor and the department. I would just mention that you know, obviously there were 16 to 1800 people that were vetted, if you will, and it was determined that they had some something in their background or some character flaw or whatever that was worthy of them, if you will, worthy of them not being selected. If it's 150, if it's 1,000, if it's 1,500, in spite of all of the applicants, I mean, I think that we have to consider that. You know, going back to the way it was before, I think that's why we're here, is we don't want to go back to the way it was before. I believe that's why this committee is here and listening to all of these presentations. And so I think that's, you know, I certainly appreciate your position. I know the position you're in, where you can't really say as much as perhaps you'd like to. But I think as a committee, speaking on behalf of the committee, if I may, I think we... You know, we have to take all of this very seriously, and we need to look at if there are legal implications. We do not want to put the state in a position where we're going to be in hot water as it relates to litigation and so forth. So we've got a couple of more presenters here, and I'm going to call an end to this discussion. Ms. Little, I certainly appreciate your efforts and in answering those questions. Thank you very much, as always, for being here. And I want to thank Elizabeth Morris as well. Did we have one more question, Senator Peterson? Or
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Montgomery, Ms. Little. But I just want to comment, if we're going to end this discussion, this is a pretty disturbing account of where we are. I hope we come back to this. We've gone from bad to worse, back to bad. You know, this system is broken, and we've got to do something about it. And the fact that there's no data from the department, any quantitative data, it alarms me as well. In my, you know, background in hiring and firing and analysis, we're missing the point here. I'll end it at that. But this is a very alarming situation that cannot continue by going backwards. I see that. Whether Mrs. Montgomery's program was effective, I don't know. She said. We need to, Mr. Chairman, revisit this. Thank you.
You're welcome, Senator Peterson, and Ms. Montgomery, thank you for your presentation. Thank you very much. And that will not be the last we hear of this. Next up, we have Robin Huffman of the North Carolina Psychiatric Association. Robin?
Great. As we switch over slide presentations, before I introduce ourselves, let me just say, if there's one thing you take away from our presentation this afternoon, is this, that prisons are safer when mental health care issues of inmates are attended to. So, thank you, Kay. Who we are. I'm Robin Huffman. I'm the Executive Director of the North Carolina Psychiatric Association. We're the professional association for almost 1,000 psychiatric physicians in North Carolina. And with me this afternoon is Kay Castillo, and Kay is the Director of Advocacy Policy and Legislation for the National Association of Social Workers of North Carolina. And we are just a couple of folks who are part of an advocacy group that cares about the treatment of prisoners in our prisons, those with mental illness. And part of our partnership includes the National Alliance for Mental Illness. It includes the North Carolina Psychological Association, as well as Disability Rights of North Carolina, which is the federally mandated protection and advocacy system for those with disabilities. And our organizations represent professionals who are the experts in the field, professionals who work in our state prisons and in our system, and also the professionals who are a workforce shortage that you hear about in some of the presentations of the last few weeks. And we're going to have you advance. There we go. Thank you.
So again, to repeat our message, better mental health care for inmates contributes to safer prison environment for the employees. It improves the long-term outcomes for the inmates themselves, and especially important, it provides for safer communities. When we know that we have 24 to 25,000 inmates who return into our communities to live in our neighborhoods every single year, it's important to know that they're being released safely and able to do well in the community. A quick history. Unfortunately, since the frequently people don't care about the prison system until they're headlines, until we read something in the newspapers, until we hear bad stories. And so our group came together back in 2011, three governors ago, to meet with leadership from the Department of Public Safety to talk about this issue. You've heard about the issues from previous presentations, and you've heard about the high prevalence in our prison system of people with addictive disease, of inmates with mental illness, and with other issues related to that. So for the last 8 years, we've been meeting with prison officials to talk about it, because one of the things that we think is important is appropriate staffing and having the appropriate care being delivered. But we also know that there is workforce shortage for nurses, for social workers, for psychologists and psychiatrists in the prison system. And we also believe that to recruit employees, medical employees, and custody officers, that we need safer prisons and for that environment. So we think this is a key recruitment and retention tool. We were speaking earlier about how to keep folks in our prison system, our custody staff. It's important to have safe prisons for retention and recruitment. So since these meetings, since 2011, we have made some progress, and we are really proud of that. One is crisis intervention training for custody officers that was introduced in Central Prison back in 2012. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. The national experts in prison mental health, psychiatrist Jeff Metzner, psychologist Stephen Ofterhide, were brought in 2012 and again in 2014 to do assessments of prison safety. In 2015, DPS received a Vera Institute of Justice grant that gave the state technical assistance for reducing restrictive housing for folks in our prison system. And North Carolina was one of only five states who got this grant. And probably more importantly than anything about progress that's been made is that back in 2015, you all, the North Carolina General Assembly, appropriated $2 million in funding to staff mental health beds and to open the therapeutic diversion units in our prison system. You heard Dr. Junker talk about that a couple of weeks ago at your last meeting. And these six units that are currently open are units that are designed to move inmates out of restrictive housing and into a more appropriate setting. One of the problems with people who have mental illness is an inability to process information well, to follow rules. We know that in the prison system, we have a lot of inmates with behavioral issues who have problems following prison rules. And so what happens is they have an infraction, they get put into solitary confinement, their mental illness gets worse as a result of this. They have more problems following rules. They do another infraction. They get back in solitary. They can't get out of solitary. So that's one of the issues that has us concerned about appropriate settings and appropriate care for inmates who have mental illness. I want to talk a minute about crisis intervention training. It's not a new topic. This is an evidence-based practice that law enforcement has been using for a long, long time. But back in 2012, North Carolina got a grant, and we sent the warden at Central Prison, a psychologist from Central Prison, and a volunteer from NAMI were sent through an NIC grant to go to Colorado to get training for crisis intervention training specific to custody officers. And this training
kind of helps teach people how to identify mental illness, the behaviors of mental illness, when it's a bad behavior and when it's just a behavior that's related to mental illness, and to give staff new tools to use when working with this population. Frequently, the tools that law enforcement and custody officers have is that command presence, you know, the command voice, the command presence. That doesn't work often with people with mental illness. And what we're seeing in communities across North Carolina, as well as in prison systems, is that the use of crisis intervention training helps give the staff new skills and new ways to deal with people with mental illness, to diffuse potentially explosive situations instead of exacerbating them. So when the warden at Central Prison came back in 2012 from this training, what he came back and told the advocacy groups, the folks that were meeting with the prison officials, is he's like, you know, about day three, I kind of started to get it, that these weren't just bad people with bad behaviors, but there's something wrong with these people's brains, and there's something different. And he came back and said, I want to put crisis intervention training in place at Central Prison. He put it in place at Central Prison and then came back with reports about the number of incidents that had gone down, that the training of his custody staff and all of his employees at Central Prison actually made the number of incidents with some violence and decrease. And we thought that was a really important kind of concept. He also showed us videos, a couple of videos of incidents where he said, look at how our trained staff are dealing with this very explosive situation. And instead of racing in with the command presence, you could see in the video how their custody staff just sort of leaned back, just kind of, you know, just looked at this inmate who was jumping up and down in a cage and had taken the door out of his room in the prison's unit. And basically, the inmate kind of calmed himself down and kind of went down and got back into his room without the door. I mean, it was just a very visual representation of why something like this is important. And what my psychiatrists, who are in and out of the prisons working with forensic cases, what they have told me over the last few years is the staff that they talk to in the prisons who have had this kind of training, how much they appreciate getting this new kind of training, having new tools, having ways to handle inmates in a different kind of way. It helps them handle tough situations better. And they feel that it gives them a safer place where they're working as well. Some other progress that we've made over the last few years, we heard Dr. Junker talk about 2 weeks ago a psychology and social work internships that have been put into place. And this brings more mental health professionals into the prison setting to be exposed to these patients and see that this is interesting work to do. You have a contract, the prison system has a contract with UNC Department of Psychiatry to provide psychiatrists at Central Prison Hospital. That's also bringing psychiatric residents into the prison system to be exposed to this work and to see that this is very interesting work for them to do. Over the last few years, a treatment mall was established back in 2014. DPS brought in an expert from Dorothea Dix Hospital to develop a treatment mall at the hospital. And probably most importantly, and we'll talk more about this afternoon, is that the adult Division of Adult Corrections established a mental health task force. And the task force charge was to improve the provision of mental health services in the Department of Adult Corrections. This was started in 2014. They brought in custody, corrections, and clinical experts from across the state to bring recommendations together. And these are going to be some of the recommendations that we talk about this afternoon. One of the reports, out of the report that was produced back in 2015 from the Mental Health Task Force, they had a number of different recommendations, but one of the ones we want to focus on is what they said. They used kind of flowery language, but what they said is that the deleterious effects of restrictive housing are cumulative. And basically, the damage that is done to inmates with mental illness, maybe even to the prison system itself, by using restrictive housing. So I'm going to turn things over to my colleague Kay to take things from here.
Hey, again, Kay Castillo with the National Association of Social Workers. Just to kind of touch on solitary confinement, there's a lot of different words used, but you may hear it as restrictive housing or SEG. And this is a practice that was kind of disbarred more than a century ago. Because of its psychological harm, the United Nations has also said that solitary confinement is a torture, human torture, and shouldn't be used. And we kind of saw back in the 80s the practice reemerged, and while possibly appropriate for some inmates, there are studies that show that it makes mental illness worse. It exacerbates psychiatric symptoms such as confusion, fearfulness, agitation, and increases psychotic episodes. Isolation can manifest long-term or even create permanent impairment for those already living with mental illness. About 2 weeks ago, in the last 2 weeks, another report came out kind of touching on how solitary confinement should not be used for inmates with serious mental illness. And that report was pretty interesting. Just kind of detailing that individuals with severe mental illness need comprehensive and coordinated care. And that coordinated care happens in the community, during incarceration, and post-release as well. So it's not just segmented to while they're incarcerated or something. It's comprehensive services kind of in the continuum of care. And that definitely the justice system should be advocating for more community mental health services as well. But for those who are incarcerated, institutions should be resourced so that they can effectively treat and manage the mental health population. The divide between the criminal justice system and the mental health system needs to be bridged to provide that better care. The key finding, I guess, of this report was really that locking someone away, putting them in solitary confinement is not treatment. It's not treatment for the mental illness, so you shouldn't expect someone's behavior to get better by putting them in solitary confinement. Another report that kind of highlighted that was a 2018 amicus brief filed by former corrections directors, and they kind of highlighted three areas that, if implemented together, would result in safer prisons, but also safer communities. And as Robin pointed out, there are about 24,000 inmates that are released back into the community every year. So we're talking a pretty significant portion. But those three things that should be done together are reducing the number of prisoners sent to solitary confinement, providing rehabilitation that instills pro-social behaviors, benefiting the prison as a whole, and reducing the amount of time spent in solitary confinement. And back in 2016 or 2017, our prison system did revise policies and limit solitary confinement to 30 days, as other states had seen success in that. And kind of as mentioned on the slide, 21 states have kind of undergone a massive solitary confinement reform in their systems. And then jumping back to the 2015 report, the mental health report that you all had said should be conducted, they kind of outlined several things, but this slide in particular talks about the solitary confinement recommendations, and that's in the very first week of restrictive housing, mental health treatment should be provided, and that's out of cell mental health treatment. So not just someone going to the door and talking to them through the door, but coming out of the cell and having a therapeutic intervention. Limit restrictive housing for under 21 years of age to 24 hours total. There are several studies that young people in solitary confinement are 19 times more likely to die by suicide. So this is especially detrimental to this age group. And then 10 hours of out of cell, again, therapeutic activity plus 5 hours leading up to a goal of having 10 hours of recreation and shower time out of cell. So that's structured therapeutic time, structured non-therapeutic time. And Dr. Metzner and Dr. Alfterheide also had mentioned in their report that 10 and 10, 10 hours therapeutic and 10 hours non-structured out of cell time. And then something that happens a lot in our system is to stop releasing inmates straight from segregation to the community. So folks who have been in solitary confinement being released straight into the community. And we have social workers who have told us before that they don't have time to be notified to offer them, you know, services, get them in the community. And so they're oftentimes releasing folks before they've had kind of that proper discharge that's needed, especially for those with mental illness. And again, these are all in the 2015 mental health report, and these are experts who are speaking to the harm that is done to the mental health population in solitary confinement. The task force also identified 11 other areas, and including suicide prevention, hiring and training employees, what we've been talking about today, that recruitment and retention, and then ahead of this committee, y'all should have received from Disability Rights, they did a breakdown of each of the 11, so you can kind of see the highlights from their report. I think it's about a 40-page report, so it's condensed very well into highlighted sections. Thanks to Disability Rights for doing that. So part of our concern is that what we've seen in recent years is that the progress has stopped. There's been no additional funding for the therapeutic diversion units. When they were first established, the goal was to continue them and put them in every facility. Nursing and mental health staff positions have been eliminated because of prolonged vacancies. So they've had to shift gears and who can we get hired into these positions and, you know, kind of be creative about that. And then after seeing the progress in the decrease in the use of restrictive housing, Dr. Junker reported to you all last meeting that the total number has increased from 3.9% of the total prison population in 2017 to 6% in just in December 2018. So our greatest concern is something we talk about a lot, and that's the stigma of mental illness, and that that mental illness isn't to blame for the recent tragic deaths, and that prisons will become less safe, not more, if we continue to roll back some of the progress that has been made. So some of our recommendations, and again, these are recommendations that come from our work and from the reports that we've mentioned here today, and that's allocating at least $12 million in funds to restore the previous progress that has been made, reducing the use of solitary confinement for inmates with mental illness. There was a House bill filed, House Bill 781, that does this. Fund additional day treatment prison programs. There is one day treatment, and it's offered in the men's system, not in the women's. Again, improving recruitment, hiring, and retention of clinical staff. I think that's a huge issue that needs to be addressed. And I know Ms. Warren mentioned that the amount of time it takes for, you know, speaking on behalf of social work to apply for the job, to be interviewed, and then start work can be 6 months or longer. And so by that time, they've had to move on. They found other jobs, and we're back to square one. And I'll say DPS has worked with us in the past about helping to recruit and hire. But with the amount of times that jobs are posted, the director of social work services would find out the position had been posted, get it to us, and there's only 2 or 3 days left in the posting. So we're shooting it out to our networks, but there's not a lot of time to do more formal than just trying to, you know, help get the word out. Renewing focus on training custody staff, restoring that crisis intervention training that Robin talked about, improving screenings and assessments at intake, and then throughout stay, improving release planning, and then requiring jails and state agencies to share medical and mental health information when an inmate moves, and being punctual, we got this slide out or this presentation done pretty early, and actually last week in the House Bill 988 was filed, and that reiterates some of these things, which is that $12 million for behavioral health services, $7.5 million for day treatment, specifically targeting women's prison, and then also that sharing of medical information. It does several other things as well, but just kind of highlighting those. So those are, you know, two bills that we mentioned, House 781 and House 988, that kind of move towards the direction of our recommendations. So in the beginning of our work, we started at Central Prison because the mental health hospital was there. And we had a Steve Webster come in, who had worked at Dorothea Dix, to set up this treatment mall. And he surveyed staff, custody staff and behavioral health staff, about what are the needs. He was trying to set up a model of you might have a skill that you could teach someone else and that sort of thing. And the survey was pretty explicit. It was, you know, why are we trying to do this? Why are we coddling people who have done bad things and that sort of thing? But once they started treatment and started crisis intervention training, they really started to understand mental illness. You know, maybe it's that some of the staff coming in had never really dealt with someone with a severe persistent mental illness before, and this was kind of a insight into what that is. And so as the treatment mall rolled out and services were being provided and more therapeutic activities were happening, staff was reporting back to us that custody staff were now asking to be moved to work with this population, that they were seeing the progress, that they felt better equipped, and that that was where they wanted to go. So we know that behavioral health treatment, and we know that services have to happen with both custody staff and behavioral health staff, that the two have to work together. They have to communicate and act, you know, kind of more in a setting like psychiatry and social work and psychology, working with colleagues to treat, to help provide treatment and get people into the services that they need. So it was really kind of inspiring to hear their stories of the shifts in the attitude and wanting to work and provide services and seeing the need as we're releasing folks and not just locking them away and assuming that they'll get better. So, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Safer prisons or skilled custody staff? And I think it's a combined effort. It's got to happen together. But prison safety will make it easier to recruit and retain. And that's speaking for behavioral health staff as well. And effective pre-release programming gives us that hope in the community that folks with mental illness will thrive in the community and not find themselves back into the system.
Okay, ladies, thank you very much for your presentation. Do we have any questions at all from our committee? Yes, Senator Van Dyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had an experience with my local police department where they gave us a day worth of de-escalation training. Mm-hmm. And so I think I kind of understand the gist of what you're trying to say. Mm-hmm. One of the things that occurred to me, though, and it was informed by the fact that I also have a son on the autism spectrum, was that this is not just a question of training, this is a question of culture. And that you have to, like, not just learn how to do it, you have to believe in it, and leadership needs to model it and make sure that's the way things are done. To do that, though, I would think that first we'd have to convince people that this actually works. I believe it works, but that doesn't mean I know anything about prisons. Is there a state or is there a prison even that does this well?
Ladies, your pick, Daily Double. Who wants to handle that question?
I'm not sure if we know the answer to that specific question. What I will say, though, Senator, is that in the early days in our beginning meetings with some of the top leadership in the department, when they started adopting CIT in North Carolina, they were looking to actually hire someone to be a full-time coordinator to coordinate the training across the system. But what we heard some of the leadership say is to the assistant secretary was, all right, we've got to do this training too. And what was, I think, most effective is that before this got started in Central Prison and in our system in North Carolina was when the warden at Central Prison went himself. And it was a change of culture. Going back to the mental health task force report that y'all have copies of, culture was one of the categories of recommendations that particular group met. There is a shift in culture that is needed, and I think having leadership, it was important to have the warden come back and say, man, I just thought these were bad people, and now I get that some of the folks in our prison are not. So there's still folks who are criminals, but there are a lot of people in our prisons who have been criminalized. It's their mental illness that may have gotten them in the route towards prison. So there is a culture shift that needs to take place.
Senator Van Dyne, thank you for your question. Let's go to Senator Bergen.
Thank you. Do you know what percentage of the prison, or what, let me ask you this, because I've heard all kinds of different numbers. What percentage of the prison population actually has a diagnosable mental health issue?
So,
yes, go ahead and just identify yourself again, please.
Kay Castillo, National Association of Social Workers, North Carolina chapter. I think part of that number is hard to identify because the screening needs to be improved. And so some inmates may fail a screening in the prison system, but in the community, they would be identified as someone needing services.
And this is Robin Huffman, the North Carolina Psychiatric Association. What we heard Dr. Junker say is that from 2007 to 2018, maybe because of some improvement in the screening, that the North Carolina numbers went, I think, from about 7% up to about 18%. What we hear nationally is the number is at least 20%. I've heard speakers at the American Psychiatric Association talk about 20 to 50% of people with serious mental illness.
Follow up from Senator Bergen.
I think that's part of the problem is we, you know, I've heard up 45%. I've talked to local sheriffs. They say 50% of their population. But so when people come into our prison system, do we do an assessment when they first come in?
Robin Huffman, North Carolina Psychiatric Association, an initial assessment is done on all the inmates. And again, it's whether or not the assessment tool is appropriate. They've changed it in the last couple of years. We think it might need to even be stronger and that more assessment needs to be done. That is more periodic. And I think the real thing that we want to talk about as well is even though there's a policy in place that someone with mental illness is only in solitary confinement for 30 days, that they're not getting reassessed every 30 days. There's not enough staff for that to take place. And so many of the folks with mental illness for whom we know the research says their mental illness will get worse are stuck in solitary confinement for 6 months at a time. And then those are the folks who are most likely to repeat. The recidivism increases, so you keep increasing the percentage of folks in our prisons with mental illness because they're the ones who get stuck in that cycle.
Senator Bergen with a follow-up.
Are you familiar with Wake Brook? Mm-hmm. All right, I spent 3 hours with them Friday, and I love their mop. They do everything in-house. They do the assessment. They do the primary care. They do the inpatient, the outpatient. What do you all think about that model?
Kay Castillo, National Association of Social Workers. I think it is effective, but again, you have to have the staff and the training of the staff to be able to do it.
And I will add another comment. Robin Huffman, North Carolina Psychiatric Association, that the former psychiatrist head of Wake Brook, who is now in the prison system, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is, it's like, if we want to improve mental health care for prisoners in our prison system, you know, one of the things we need to do is get more custody staff and train them better. That's in addition to hiring more of the mental health and medical professionals that are needed.
Senator Bergen, follow up.
Do you think there's any merit to trying to put that population all together in one or two locations in the state so that you could concentrate on their needs rather than a general population?
Ladies?
Oh, Senator. Robin Huffman, NCPA. I'm not clinical, so I'm not sure that I'm the right person to ask that. I can argue both sides. I think the therapeutic diversion units, you know, one of the things that you want to have is, when I think about psychiatric care for the general population, you want people to be cared for closer to their homes, so families can be involved in that kind of thing. I would defer to some of our forensic psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers for that.
Senator Bergen, one more follow-up.
I promise, the last one.
Fine. That's fine. You're good.
Just from the facilities I've been to and seen, I would rather see us do intense and practical work and get somebody back out if they need to be medicated or otherwise, than to keep people in a facility.
Yes.
You know, even if they had to be away from their home, if they could be there for 3 months instead of being in a prison for 3 years and spend half that time in solitary confinement. So you all think through that and respond sometime. Well, that's all.
I'd love to have a follow-up conversation with you, Senator, about that. I think that's a...
Thank you, Senator Bergen, for your question. Senator Waddell.
Thank you, and thank you for this report. One of my questions has been answered, but I would like to know, I'm looking at the $12 million. Is this new money, or is it additional funds including what's already been allocated?
CAKE is still a National Association of Social Workers. It would be in addition to money that had already been allocated.
Follow up, Senator Waddell.
Yes. If this is additional money, mm-hmm. is there somewhere a plan, I know it cannot be here, for the utilization of these funds and how the money would be used in some kind of way that the results we can see as a result of the funds?
Sure. CAKE is still a National Association of Social Workers. When the previous money was allocated, they did keep up with how many therapeutic diversion units they started, how many patients they had seen and treated, and what they had done. I don't have those figures, but I would assume that something like that would be attached to funding with the report of how that's spent.
Senator Waddell, follow up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Looking at your other recommendation when you talk about restrictive housing, mm-hmm. I think earlier we had legislation that separated youth from adults. Mm-hmm. I said that youth could not be in consolidated confinement at all. So in your earlier presentation, you mentioned that you didn't think this was a good idea at all. So, the solitary confinement.
Oh yes, yeah.
But at the same, yeah. But at yeah. the same time, you're saying limited to 30 days. So, which is it?
So we've given you a lot of information. This is Robin Huffman from the Psychiatric Association. So we have given you a report that was produced by the Department of Adult Corrections back in 2015 that made recommendations, and we gave you the full report as well as a summary of the report. And that recommendation that anyone under the age of 21 not be put into solitary confinement for more than 24 hours. And that was the recommendation of that group that was led by a consultant, by staff at DPS. So those were their recommendations. And even their recommendations, which took, you know, they're like, we can't get rid of it entirely. They even recommended that we needed to reduce how much restrictive housing was put in place. We just saw something from the Cook County Jail, which is a huge jail population, where I think for the last 3 years, they have totally eliminated solitary confinement in their jail system, totally. And this jail directors, like, people said this couldn't be done, but it has been done. And so that is an example in a jail population of moving, changing in the culture and moving to other kinds of means.
Senator Riddell, follow up.
This last one. You mentioned here also your recommendations is to share the information between mental health and other agencies. And I've seen this request between agencies before, and it's been very, very difficult to achieve. So what is the method that you have that you've seen that will make it a good model?
Ladies.
Robin Huffman, NC Psychiatric Association. I think what we're talking about is having to, and this is something y'all can do. This is, in fact, it's in the bill that Kay mentioned earlier, is actually requiring jails to have a memorandum of understanding with DPS in order to make sure that medical information from someone who moves from jail into prison follows the person. And that kind of information, when someone comes straight into prison, will help in that assessment aspect, and will give staff the kind of information they need to know to improve care, you know, and admission into the prison.
And if I can, Kay Castillo, National Association of Social Workers, I think that information is also key, because we've had social workers identify too late that a patient had a guardian, for example, who made medical decisions on their behalf, but the guardian hadn't been consulted because it wasn't identified. But you'd also want to know what medication they needed so you could continue that medication as they're transferred and ensure that they get it. It just would kind of create a follow the patient type of model instead of finding out too late that the person had, you know, mental health medications that they hadn't been taken for over a week or so.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Senator Waddell, thank you for your questions. Members of the committee, thank you for your attendance and your questions. And this meeting is now adjourned. We will meet again next Monday at 5 p.m. Thank you very much for being here. Meeting adjourned. 3 p.m.